Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Elizabeth Cohn and Cyril Ghosh to talk about their new book, Citizenship. And this is part of a series called Key Concepts in Political Theory. And this is published by Polity Books. The book was published just this year in 2019, I believe. And it's kind of a shorter book. But it is complex and fascinating and gets to the heart of the complexity of the idea, the concept, and an understanding of both the term and the application of citizenship. But I'm going to let Elizabeth and Cyril talk about that. First, I'd like to introduce Elizabeth Cohn and Cyril Ghosh to the New Books in Political Science podcast and ask them each to tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this project.
All right. Thank you so much, Lily. It's great to get to chat again about political theory with you. I am a political scientist. I specialize in citizenship theory and immigration, and I've written a couple books on related topics, Semi-Citizenship in Democratic Politics in 2009 and The Political Value of Time in 2018. And I think that this project came to us because there's so much overlap between both what Cyril and I do and then this kind of general idea of introducing what questions about what citizenship means.
And hi, Lily. Thanks for doing this. We're very happy to be here. I'm Cyril. And like Elizabeth, I'm also a political scientist. I write on three different related areas, like American political thought, sexuality and politics, and citizenship and immigration. And then we wrote this book.
How did you each come to the book itself? I mean, obviously your backgrounds and your academic and scholarly pursuits are in the areas of citizenship and in Elizabeth's case also immigration. But I also wanted to know about how the collaboration came about, particularly in this particular series, Key Concepts in Political Theory.
So I had a conversation with the editor for the series some time back, and the series was at that point had a few entries. It's a relatively new series. Polity does key concepts books, and they wanted to expand into political theory. I think it was a really good decision by the editor to view citizenship as something that should go in the theory series rather than in the general series, because it allows a lot of conceptual work that interrogates things people often take for granted about citizenship. So we had that conversation, and I asked if we could team up, Cyril and I. We've been good friends and colleagues for a really long time, and I knew that we would work well together. So I talked to the editor and I talked to Cyril, and we decided that that would be a really good fit.
And so I wanted to then ask you about this, the sort of the theoretical approach. This book is complex, as I said, but it also kind of tries to get at not only the idea of citizenship, but also why it's a complicated concept. And that's kind of where you lead off in the introduction and the first chapter of the book. So can you talk a little bit about why this term itself, that again, we sort of think we know what we're talking about when we talk about the term citizen and citizenship, but in fact, we might not be as clear on that as we think we are.
Sure. As I mentioned, I teach graduate and undergraduate classes on both citizenship and immigration, and it is the case that when we start the semester, I have to both remind myself and sit down with all the students and say, okay, this word, you're using it in a bunch of different ways. Chances are mostly you're using it and will not be able to stop using it as a proxy for simply having a passport. So if you say so-and-so has citizenship, you're referring to one kind of facet. But if I ask you in the context of talking about people's political engagement, we might bring up the word citizenship and mean something totally different that has nothing to do with whether somebody has a passport or not. So that's just a way of entering a conversation about this essentially contested concept, citizenship, and the fact that we're not just kind of having some semantic slippage or disagreement. It just is a really complex word and concept.
I might add a couple things to that, to what Elizabeth is saying. Both Elizabeth and I have previously written stuff where we had to clarify something as an essentially contested concept. So Elizabeth's book on semi-citizenship, she actually talks about how it's really hard to pin citizenship onto one precise and definite delimited definition. And I've had to do this to clarify the concept of the American Dream, which is the first book that I wrote. And routinely in classrooms, we run up against, in political theory classes, we run up against concepts like, I don't know, individualism or ideology, or politics even. And we've had to say to our students that, you know, there's, you know, These concepts are not easy to define, like they have multiple meanings. And so Terry Eagleton, for example, talks about, like, you know, six different forms of meanings that the word ideology can facilitate or enable. And Stephen Lukes has talked about individualism and so on and so forth. Like a word like religion, for example, you know, it's really hard to say what the definition of the term is. And so we do this on a daily basis with our students, but also we've written on this individually, separately. So that's the thing that we do, is we try to explain that although it is really hard to define the concept, it's not like an anything goes situation. There are core things we are talking about when we use the word.
And so that's where I wanted to take you next, which is the sort of the, after the introduction, the chapter, What is Citizenship? And again, you know, we want people to potentially buy the book, so you don't have to tell all the secrets. But as you say, this is a contested term. It's a complex term. It's more than, you know, this idea of having a passport or exercising the right to vote, or how you got your citizenship. Is it birthright, naturalization, through marriage? So can we talk a little bit about how the book sketches out this approach to thinking about what is citizenship?
Yeah. I think that one thing to say right before I say anything else, and I know Cyril will want to add to this as well, but is that this is one cut at defining citizenship, and there are plenty of good ways to go about doing this. So we start with looking at kind of where the authority to decide or hand out or assign citizenship comes from. And so the act of making decisions about who can be called a citizen and who isn't a citizen is the act of boundary drawing, and where the authority for boundary drawing lies. Frequently, most frequently, we think it lies with the state, and that states assign citizenship as a status. But there may be circumstances in which people see other authorities coming into play. So we do a lot of work talking about the importance of the state. We also look then at the content. What is it that's being offered when people say that they have citizenship? And we look at, you know, thinking about citizenship as a rights granting kind of institution. And then we also look at the types of thinker that we look at thinkers who think of citizenship as not just rights, but also certain types of engagement. We look at what citizenship is also what citizenship is not. So other forms of membership that one might be tempted to think about as citizenly memberships, but that we think are quite distinct, not just subjecthood, but also lots of other types of organization memberships that you can have as a way of in a kind of negative not light, saying this is what it's not. It's not nationality. It's not subjecthood. It's not other forms of group membership.
I don't have anything much to add to what Elizabeth is saying, except that I know at some point during the podcast we're going to get to the discussion about determinants of citizenship and how we grant that. Like, if it's birthright, is it based on territory? Is it blood lineage? So I'll just wait for that to happen, and we'll say more about this.
Well, then I'll go right there, because that's easy enough. because I think that's also where, you know, our students and most of the, you know, sort of the populations of a lot of the countries that we start talking about, that's where people immediately go when they start to think about citizenship, is like, how did you get it? What are the rules? And who's determining? I know that you're both a kind of expert on who's determining what the rules are with regard to the attainment or the taking away of citizenship. So please, Cyril and Elizabeth, talk a little bit about those determinants.
I can begin this part of the discussion. I think there's been some contestation about what the right answer is in terms of how we decide how to grant citizenship. Now, one of the ways we do this is that we say one has birthright citizenship. In the U.S., for example, since the 14th Amendment, all persons born within the territory of the United States is a citizen, and what that means is if the place of birth decides. So if you're born on the soil, and the Latin expression used to describe this is jus soli. And a competing form or way of granting citizenship is the doctrine of jus sanguinis, which is the idea that there is the right of blood. As in, if I'm genetically connected to a citizen of a state, I would then be entitled to citizenship of that state. So these are the two predominant ways in which, at least the way citizenship is practiced, the way it is granted, we do this. Now, of course, there's a set of other ways in which one can become a citizen. So one can naturalize into a country. One can marry into it, depending on the country. And actually, depending on the country and the time, the temporal context. There's also adoption. So one can be adopted by a citizen or a pair of citizens and acquire citizenship in that way. Now, is there any one right answer? And we describe in the book that actually it's often the first reaction among people living in liberal democracies is that birthright citizenship or citizenship by soil is, or territory is the right answer. And blood lineage is sort of, is kind of, it's looked upon as slightly exclusionary. But as we describe in the book, that the reality is actually a bit more complicated. The antecedents of how those things developed are make us think that there is no one right answer. A combination of all of these policies, jus soli, jus sanguinis, jus matrimoni, adoption, naturalization, all of these things together should inform citizenship in liberal democracies.
And I was wondering then, in terms of talking about this in context of liberal democracies, we're talking about developed countries. We are also talking about developing countries and countries that may not be liberal democracies as well. And you sort of dive into some of this, the origins of these concepts with regard to political theory. And this is, again, the book is in the context of a series in political theory. And so I'd love for either of you or both of you to talk a little bit about where we find some of the theories within the corpus of political theory on citizenship and how that has contributed to some of our thinking on it.
Yeah, so the history of political thought on citizenship, it is often kind of one of the most surprising sets of ideas to people who are thinking casually about citizenship but haven't done a deep dive, and something that's it's almost hard to convey if you haven't read the sources is how different citizenship in its modern form is from any of its antecedents. The ancient traditions of citizenship, and particularly Greek and in particular Athenian citizenship, were highly exclusionary, and not just within the boundary, not just exclusionary in the sense that there were boundaries and outsiders, territorial outsiders, or even outsiders in terms of their blood lineage, jus sanguinis. Those were not the only boundaries of exclusion. The boundaries of exclusion were drawn around affluence, so the ability to have enough leisure time and independence from need to be able to think about the good of the whole, and kind of being the head of one's household. Those were really important prerequisites for citizenship. So the kind of idea of the ability to be equal was one that was very narrowly construed and excluded women and anybody who was not a property owner and was not self-sufficient. And you see that really starkly in the politics, in Aristotle's Politics. And it's not until we start to get liberal thinkers, and only certain liberal thinkers, that we open up the idea of citizenship to more of the population, or open up the demos to more of the population. Cyril's done a lot of work on, a lot of thinking about Locke, and he may want to jump in here a little bit and talk about the ways in which this transformation starts to happen.
So what we do is we use sort of nodes, historical nodes, to signal how major transformations have happened from the ancient conceptualization to then we sort of give some details about social contract theory. And we talk about Locke and Rousseau in particular, and the two very starkly different models of citizenship that they are thinking of, although they're not using that specific word. And in Locke, of course, the idea is that, you know, it's the consent of the governed, sovereignty is in the people, and so on and so forth. And it's less about political participation. In Rousseau, it's quite a bit about political participation, the active participation of all citizens together in a deliberative democracy. And then the next node we sort of look at is the American and French revolutions. And Jefferson, of course, is famously involved in the text of both the American Declaration of Independence and the Declaration of the Rights of Man. And in those iterations, we see a real like formal codification of this idea of equality before the law, the consent of the governed, and at least in one of those instances, the right to revolution based on a long train of abuses against a tyrant. And so this is the beginning of the sort of what then becomes the contemporary liberal idea of citizenship, which is which then is taken by some to be in sort of the dialectical opposite of a civic republican idea of citizenship. When and Elizabeth and I are we are quite careful, I think, to point out that this distinction between a liberal contemporary notion of citizenship and a civic republican contemporary notion of citizenship that is invested in political participation, there's no neat divide between the two concepts. I mean, they are sort of, they're inflected by each other. There are differences, but they're not quite as, there are no major chasms between the two as some people would like to argue. Now, and you did say something about critical theory, and I think one of the things we do is we point out that once we have this established canon of two, actually, let's call it three, basically, ways of thinking about contemporary citizenship. One is the liberal form, the second is the civic republican form, and a third, coming out of Roger Smith's work on multiple traditions, where Smith identifies in the U.S. that various ascriptive hierarchies have always already coexisted with both the liberal tradition and the civic republican tradition. Now, after that critique of these two main ideas, various people have said many things challenging the concept of citizenship as it is understood in the dominant traditions, like the liberal and civic republican. And when we describe those critiques, we point out, among other things, the feminist critique of citizenship, for example, the queer critique of citizenship. We talk about the multicultural citizenship, for example, which talks not only about, at least in Will Kimlicka's case, not only does he talk about liberal individual rights, but also group differentiated rights and how these two things can coexist. And so on and so forth. There we do a couple of other things when we are reviewing the literature on the critiques to contemporary citizenship. And one of the things we do is we talk about the non-state-centric approaches to citizenship. And within that sort of rubric, we discuss ideas like post-national citizenship, sub-national citizenship, quasi-citizenship, dual citizenship, and so on. And finally, we talk about the non-anthropocentric approaches, like, you know, the citizenship of the environment, of animals, and some theorists have critiqued the dominant iterations of citizenship as being under-inclusive, and that we should really think in terms of a broader set of things when we're thinking of it.
And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the sort of critiques of citizenship that you do delve into in terms of understanding how we have perhaps evolving, perhaps not, understandings of what it means to be a citizen and sort of how we individually position ourselves within groups of which we are citizens or from which we potentially feel excluded because of, you know, the contours of inclusion and exclusion within this concept. Can either of you talk a little bit about some of those critiques of, you know, sort of the more traditional understandings of citizenship?
Yeah, I mean, I think, one of the, just to double back a little bit and slot in a little more robust sense of contemporary thought on citizenship. You know, there's a canonical literature that looks at or that treats citizenship through a liberal lens and looks at citizenship as a set of rights. The classic text is T.H. Marshall for many reasons. That's both a very useful foil, but is inadequate. And it Marshall looks at these kind of civil, political, and social rights and their relationship to each other and sets up very nicely the fact that or the opportunity for people to look at the tradition and say, oh, all people do not have all of these rights. And that's, I'm certainly not the only person who's worked in that area, but I have worked in that area. And you can start to kind of see that this idea of social closure, to use Rogers Brubaker's words about citizenship, that citizenship is really about social closure, or even if we were to expand that and say citizenship is really its goal is political closure, doesn't really work that way. In fact, you know, the boundaries of citizenship can be quite porous in both directions. People can get pushed out of the citizenry or pushed out of some of the nodes of citizenship, the bundles of rights, and people can get partially pulled in without being completely pulled in. And there are many instances we talk about the political status of temporary residents, workers, other types of visitors. We talk about the status of undocumented persons, of children, of people who are being punished for crimes, and use those cases to demonstrate that this idea that citizenship, because it draws boundaries, must be closing boundaries entirely, that that's really not actually something that the state wants to or is able to accomplish very fully.
And so I wanted to also ask you, as you sort of complete the book, the last section of the book is also about people who aren't citizens or statelessness and an understanding of, you know, sort of contemporary situations, as you talk about also those who are moving from being citizens of a place where they are potentially threatened or compromised, and then ending up in a situation where they do not have what we might consider the protections of citizenship. Can you talk a little bit about how the research and the discussion of these concepts leads in that direction as well?
Right. I think by the time we finished writing this book, there wasn't very much doubt that the topics like refuge and refugee law, statelessness, asylum, are some of the most salient issues in the how states practice citizenship in the 21st century. And although there is now, you know, well over half a century's worth of attempts to collaborate on the just to prevent really extreme instances of differentiated or semi-citizenship where people have very, very diminished rights, particularly rights of place, the right to move freely and the right to have a home, a place that will accept somebody on a permanent basis. That cooperation has failed, and there are large numbers of displaced persons, people maybe who only have temporary protected status or who are long-term residents of camps or who are internally displaced and can't get any protection outside in a state outside of a state where they don't feel safe. So we have lots of language to talk about extreme instances of where there, people don't have any citizenship protections, but we have not members of polities actually been able to protect people, and you know, both European countries and the US and a lot of countries that are adjacent to recent conflicts that have produced refugees are kind of piecing together, in many cases, pretty inhumane responses to the need, the political and material needs of these individuals and families.
The closing of the book is in at least in my estimation, it's kind of a natural progression of the discussion of the book. I think that we couldn't not close the book in the way in which we did, and I'll try to explain why. So one of the things that Elizabeth and I have really, really tried hard to point out is that citizenship is a gradient category. Elizabeth has done previous work on this, and we try to explain that it's not a binary, like an on-off switch, that you either have it or you don't. And lots of people, like disenfranchised felons, for example, or some personnel in the armed forces who are denied the right to a civil trial, and versions of semi-citizenship we see everywhere. But one of the things that we then also have to think about is not just semi-citizenship, but actually the really most attenuated form of citizenship or personhood. And we sort of had an ethical obligation to also address that issue, which then of course entailed that we do again another clarification of the concepts. And it's a very confusing literature, like what is a refugee? What is an economic migrant? Who is an asylum seeker? Who is an asylee? Who is an internally displaced person? Who has temporary protected status? These things are not easy for an ordinary person who's not doing the research to just, keep in mind at all times. So we try to explain what the differences are. And then, of course, we, in so doing, have to address the question of statelessness, somebody who doesn't have a passport at all, and no state recognizes it or them as a member of their polity. And when we were thinking about doing that section of the concluding chapter, I remember Elizabeth and I going back and forth about how many sort of case studies we would look at just to explain what's happening. And we ended up, I think, with three or four in the beginning, and then we had to eliminate a couple of those, and we retained sort of focused case studies on two, one on the Rohingya in Myanmar and the other of the EU migration crisis. But we could have instead elected to write about, Palestinian people in the Palestinian territories and elsewhere and all sorts of other groups. But we ended up focusing on these two cases because we just wanted to actually pay, adequate attention to what's going on with the experience of statelessness among these groups. And once we did that, we couldn't then not write about this very, very controversial debate within the discipline on open borders. And we then tried to explain what the arguments for and against are. And we hope to bring some clarity to the debate about open borders, like why some people will say, well, you can still retain cultural sovereignty and deny people access to rights and goods while opening your border. And that's an important point to make. Adam Cox makes it, for example, and we explain all these things with the hope that after reading that section, one has a clear idea of what the main arguments are on both sides of that.
Just to backtrack a little bit, yeah. Sorry to speak over you. I just, I think one of the things that we tried to do in order to make this book a little bit, even though it's a very succinct textbook that's accessible for undergraduates and graduate students or people who don't work in the area but want to get a quick read on citizenship, we do try, as Cyril said, to apply concepts, particularly complicated concepts like refuge and asylum. And we, as he brought up these cases, we try really hard not to repeat the mistake that some of the critiques of the citizenship canon have pointed out, which is focusing only on Western cases and Western understanding. So we, in those sections, include discussion of, you know, the fact, like, we could have focused everything, as anybody who's listening, who's been thinking about U.S. politics recently, could have focused everything on the crisis at the southern U.S. border, which is ongoing since the Obama administration. But we try to show that these are actually not just, you know, unusual occurrences. They're happening frequently and throughout the world.
And that was what I found to be fascinating in the way that you do close the book, is that you sort of note that these complicated understandings of citizenship also lead to these other components of our thinking about individuals and humans, where they are and how that impacts who they are and how they conduct themselves. And that then bleeds into this conversation or consideration of things like borders, and what are borders and how does that interact with these concepts. I found the book to be really, as you say, succinct, but very complex and helpful in explaining a lot of these concepts. So thank you for that. And I'm hoping that you will each now tell me a little bit about what you're working on now. I assume that your sort of considerations and your interests are continuing along these same paths.
Mm-hmm. You guessed correctly. I just finished a new book that's coming out in January of 2020. And I will say that this has been an intense year because neither of us is dashing this stuff off. So I finished a book on immigration enforcement in the United States very recently. And the book is partly a history that takes people through the invention of the undocumented immigrant. So looking at, you know, the fact that there was a time not that long ago when we didn't have undocumented immigrants in the United States because we didn't render anybody's presence illegal, and what it did to us once we decided to create this category and start policing our borders. Just to give a little spoiler, the one thing it didn't do was stop undocumented immigration or change our demographics with respect to immigration at all. But lots of things did happen. And so I take the reader through that history, looking at how white nationalists influenced policy, things like that, and then also provisions that could actually move us back to a more sustainable approach to undocumented immigration and to our borders and border crossing more generally. So that's out January 28th, I think, in 2020. Looking forward to that.
And I hope you'll come and talk to me about it.
I can't wait.
And Cyril?
So I'm doing a couple different things, but what Elizabeth didn't say is that this book she's mentioning is her fourth. And I think that it takes a lot of stamina to write four books. And so I'm taking a little bit of a rest right now because this citizenship book is my third. So I'm working on shorter pieces. But more seriously, the pieces, there's two different types of things I'm doing. One is on asylum law and sexuality and sort of sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, and sex characteristics claims that we can make when we are asking for asylum, and how a receiving country adjudicates, like, what is a fraudulent claim and what is not. So it's work in the it's work which is sort of in theory and law and sexuality. So that's one thing that I'm doing. And the other thing I'm doing actually is, okay, so I'm the program chair for sexuality and politics at the APSA this year, and next year I'm serving as the president. And one of the things we're genuinely worried about is the very meager appearance of research in the field of sexuality and politics in mainstream political science journals. Now I am undecided that this is the result of some prejudice or deliberate marginalization. I don't know if that is true. I don't think it is. But I do actually want to do some research, some content analysis on looking at just exactly how meager it is. So I've been, I presented a version of this, an early iteration of this at the APSA this year, and I'm working on this. It's an ongoing project. And hopefully I will be done by the end of the spring semester with it. And I intend to document the ongoing lack of presence for sexuality and politics research within the discipline. And so that's the other thing. But the asylum thing is closer to completion. So that's what I'm doing.
Well, I hope that if one of these aspects becomes a book, that you'll also come back on the New Books podcast and talk
yes,
to me about
for sure.
It.
Yep.
So I wanted to thank Elizabeth Cohn and Cyril Ghosh for talking to me today about their new book, Citizenship. This is published by Polity Press in 2019, and it's part of Polity's series, Key Concepts in Political Theory. I assume one can buy this text at Polity's website.
Correct.
Yeah,
you can buy it at all the usual suspect places. So Powell's, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, and everything in between.
Okay.
Anywhere books are sold.
Anywhere books are sold.
And I just wanted to take a moment, Lily, to thank you for all the work you do on this podcast, because I listen to them all the time. I feel really fortunate. I think we're all fortunate to have you helping us gain access to the array of new books that are being published, and you and Heath do a huge service. And I know it's a lot of work to read the books and craft the interviews. And so I just wanted to say thank you for that.
And I want to echo that for sure. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that and for joining me today. I appreciate it.